Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, April 7th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, the first quarter wrap-up. I'm a big person on frameworks. I like to have a framework for my view of the world, what's going on, for particularly for planning purposes. I'm a big planner. And the wrap-ups, we do one once a year. We just had the year-end wrap-up in the first week of January. And there's a wonderful write-up of that. If you haven't gotten it, I would really recommend you check it out, because I go through all the big trends that we're going to be dealing with and we're dealing with. And it's a great place to begin building your framework. And so check it out. It's at the, you can access it at the control panel. The wrap-ins are the time when I like to do a check-in on the framework. How are we doing? What happened? What changed? And that's important because we're in a period where the change is accelerating and getting more and more, in many cases, violent. So it's very important to do that check-in, and I welcome the opportunity to kind of pause and look at where we are. My theme tonight is appreciate the miracle. If you didn't listen to the interview with Dr. Gwen Scott, I encourage you to do it. We were talking about the 10 action steps you can take to protect your health against chemtrails, and this came out of my discussion with her. And we repeated it again when we were doing the interview on the phone. She said, you know, if you look at what's in the water and if you look at what's been happening to the air and the drop in oxygen, and if you look at what's been going on with the food, the reality is, from any logical standpoint, we should be dead. But we're not. So something miraculous is going on. There's something at work here. And we need to appreciate it and access it. And one of the things I think, you know, the slow burn is very grinding. You're looking at a steady increase of rules and regulations, rise in expenses, drops in income, changing economic conditions, increased risk. It can be very, very grinding. And the word I always use is draining. And in the face of that, it is so important to use the power of our imagination to kind of jump the curve constantly on our situation. And it's one of the reasons tonight in Let's Go to the Movies I'm going to be discussing the German fantasy epic Neverending Story, both part one and part two. It's really a three-part series. I'm just going to be discussing the first two. So I want to talk tonight about, I want to focus on a couple of the situations that we're facing, because in combination, clearly the slow burn is accelerating. It's digging in, you know, we've burnt through a lot of fat. We're digging into real muscle now. It's getting ugly. But we face a couple of situations which in combination could be very dangerous. And so I want to focus on them. The three of them are federal budget squabble, what's the tsunami and the aftermath, particularly with Fukushima in Japan, and then war in the Middle East and Northern Africa. Number one, federal shutdown. As we speak now, the president is meeting at the White House with congressional leaders, trying to finalize a deal on the federal budget. Without such a deal coming out of the meeting tonight, the president is going to veto, and we're going to end up with a government shutdown. We've had agencies and a variety of players all working this week to deal with it. Now, what is this about? There is, as part of the appropriation process, there's something called a debt limit, and the Treasury can only issue as much debt as is approved by Congress in the debt limit. Treasury is not allowed to issue more debt than that, although there are many different sort of ways you can wiggle and circumvent. Now, what that means is where the House and the Senate, it could be across the lines, or it could be House and Senate, cannot resolve an increase in the debt limit, and usually other issues, particularly the deficit, are held hostage to that, you get a shutdown. Now, these shutdowns can be quite fractious. It was, during the Clinton administration, it was the 95 shutdown, 94-95, that led the sort of decision at the top of the country to kind of give up on America and pull all the money out. It was very much part of sort of, we've had it, we're pulling the money out and leaving. So it can be a very frustrating time for a lot of people, because there's real challenges within the political system of getting the different constituencies to be financially responsible. when I worked as a regulator and when I worked again as a financial advisor with the, you know, both a Republican and then a Democratic administration, you had every constituency coming in and saying, you know, I'm here to get my thing, you know, and I really don't care what the impact on the whole system is. So nobody's taking responsibility for the whole. And that's a problem. It's not a problem in a state government, because a state government, you can't spend more than you take in. But with the federal credit mechanism that's been created, there's no way of saying no. And because we've seen such a deterioration in financial controls, no financial statements, no compliance, there's kind of no way to shut off the spigot other than literally to collapse the whole mechanism. And so the challenge politically is, how do you create something that is financially accountable? Part of that is within the different programs, healthcare being a perfect example. All sorts of constituencies have built up a whole bunch of rules about what you can and cannot do. So the pro-centralization team has said, you know, suppress all this low-cost technology. We want expensive pharmaceuticals. Well, that just keeps driving the budget up. And so we have an inability to resolve our political differences and to optimize the resources at hand. And that situation is turning negative. One of the big reasons it's turning negative, and I have to keep ringing this bell because I really want you to understand this and get into your spirit. For many, many years, the Social Security Fund, which is a trust fund, has had a surplus, and that has financed the deficit. Now, for the first time, Social Security is turning negative. And what that means is the fundamental framework is changing. At the same time, we have three big pigs trying to get through the snake, one being the military, one being the interest on the national debt, which PS, you know, reflects interest rates that are down, you know, in the basement, they're so low, and Social Security / healthcare. And so all, you know, one or some of these sacred cows are all going to have to be dealt with, and that's a whole new thing. Now, as you know, I've been very, very worried about what could happen with 401ks. Now, one of the few bright spots here is it appears that 401ks and IRAs have kind of been backburnered while they deal with the bigger issues of Social Security and health care and the sort of big framework. But it's so just, you know, so take it, you know, breathe easy if you have a 401k and IRA, but that issue is going to come up again, and the question is when, and I continue to monitor and watch that. Now, let me just mention that there are a couple of other things going on in the background in addition to Social Security turning negative. Americans as a society are very used to having real power. We had power as consumers because power globally in the economy was having access to what was at the time the biggest consumer market. We're no longer the biggest consumer market, and what we're watching is an effort to rebalance the global economy to be dependent on the global consumer, not the American consumer. So that's a real shift in sort of power. The second thing is American voting counted. The system was very managed and manipulated, but it did count. Computer voting is changing that. The final thing is, in addition to Social Security, we have a whole generation of baby boomers who were saving and producing capital and investing. That money moved into the pension funds, it moved into the banks, it moved into the Social Security Trust Fund, IRAs, 401k. As I've talked about a lot, I'm not going to go into tonight, an effort, you know, the financial coup d'etat basically moved that money out. And so now we're in the end game when a whole group of people have to cope with the overwhelming realization, you know, that as that, I forget who it was who said in the movie, you have been had, baby, but, you know, essentially our money's been stolen, and the mechanism as of yet has not appeared to get it back. Anyway, so we're watching a rebalancing, and I think it's going to be hard for a lot of Americans to come to the grips with the fact that the whole political power equation between big government and individuals has essentially financially reversed. You know, we've gone from being a cash generator to a cash user, and part and parcel of this is the we've seen the big corporations create highly educated, highly motivated workforces elsewhere who can compete even at the white-collar level. So the background on this is pretty, pretty ugly and painful. Now, so we've seen the Republicans pushing hard. One of the reasons they're pushing hard is the dollar is falling. If you look at the U.S. dollar, it's funny, I gave a presentation in Mill Valley in 2004, and we put it up on the web called Navigate the Falling Dollar, and it kind of says it all. It's, you know, it's funny, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But the dollar's falling, and it's falling as a percentage of the international transactions. And it's one of the reasons that the squabbling around the oil card and oil is getting so tough, so fractious. But the falling dollar means that the debasement we've been in with QE2 has really, it's very, very painful in a lot of ways. You know, obviously, if you're a saver, you're being debased. A lot of people are being debased. But the people it's the most painful for are the ones who depend on the fundamental mechanism to work. And the fundamental mechanism is being steadily weakened, and the question is how much longer can it hold? And that's really ultimately a military question. Now, how long have shutdowns been? Generally, we've seen shutdowns from 3 to 21 days. The longer they last, the trickier they can be. Social Security will continue. That's a trust fund. Post office will continue. That's paid from fees like a private or a quasi-public corporation. A lot of essential services will continue. We saw Alan Grayson, one of the Congress people who makes me laugh the most, send out a note today. Let me read it to you. Dear concerned citizen, unless you've been living in a cave recently, Osama, you can stop reading here, you know that Republicans have blocked the passage of the appropriation bills that apply to all federal spending between April 8th and September 30th, so we are facing a government shutdown. And as the White House has patiently pointed out, that means no more government-backed mortgages, which now account for 95% of the housing market. That's a very important point. So if this gets to a long shutdown, you're basically shutting down the new mortgage market. The housing market certainly has enough trouble. But that could be quite a whack on the market. Okay, let me continue the letter. No more government student loans. No more government small business loans. No pay for the troops who are now embroiled in three wars. They still have to fight. They just won't be paid for it, despite the 13th Amendment. No tax refunds, just 1 week before taxes are due. Let me just mention taxes continue to be due, so the collections continue, but not the refunds. No federal grants for roads, schools, or pretty much anything else, and hundreds of thousands of federal employees added to the unemployment rolls. But there's one thing you can still do if the government shuts down. You can go broke. I'm a licensed attorney, and yesterday I received this cheerful reminder from a bankruptcy court to which I'm admitted. The court will continue to operate business as usual on Monday, April 11, 2011. The staff, the bankruptcy court explained, will be paid out of fee revenue and other sources. Anyone who wants to petition for bankruptcy will be welcome to do so. Anyway, wonderful question from one of our subscribers. Are the federal budget crisis and the possible closing of the Smithsonian a slow burn? They're certainly part of the slow burn, but it's it's a little bit potentially of a departure in the sense that it's more dramatic, and what they're trying to do is create a framework so they can continue to slow burn, and they think it's important to do that because if they don't, the dollar could drop in ways that are even more expensive than the cutbacks we might see. So it's a bit of a dance. Now, let me tell you where the risk lies. This is an opportunity. This is going to give the Republicans an opportunity to roll state and local government, because two of the parties in a long shutdown who could be most harmed is the state and local governments depending on federal payments. So you could get they're grappling with huge budget deficit problems and a real effort by Republicans at the local level to do significant reengineerings. I should say the Republicans are leading the charge, but if you look at the forces behind this, it's much bigger than that. If you shut off the cash, it makes it that much easier to roll them because they won't have the cash to fight with. So one opportunity is we could see some really ugly and the wrong kind of breakthroughs at state and local government. The second is whenever you get a shutdown like this, it's a chance for anybody who considers themselves an opportunist or an enemy to take a shot. And so the opportunities for the breakaway civilization to slam down, buy up cheap, play games, the opportunities for disaster capitalism just increase. So it's a time when people take advantage and they make crazy. It's particularly ugly with these cash flows stopping at tax time, because tax time is a time when people really feel the pain of increased regulatory burden, which has been increasing tremendously for the last couple of years. It has for decades, but the last round of reform has been very painful. So it's coming at tax time. People are feeling the pain of how much time they have to spend dealing with taxes and the ugliness of paying money into a system in which you're basically financing people who are turning around and using that money to do serious harm to you and your family in a whole variety of ways. They're lying to you, et cetera, et cetera. So it makes it that much harder, and we see, you know, America was founded on a tax revolution, so taxes tend to bring out the most revolutionary spirit, because it's the nut-cutting time. It's the time when you really have to say, okay, how much am I putting into the system? What am I getting out? One of the things that we've been noticing during this is there's unprecedented propaganda. So if you look at the employment numbers, if you look at the inflation numbers, the amount of lies are just, you know, they're kind of getting to the point where it's comedy. And one of the things I'm thinking about doing is, what are the things I buy every week or every month that I can just start to track the price, so I can have a much better sense of the numbers. I love and use Shadow Stats. We've had John Williams on. His work is very helpful, but for dealing with household commodities and budgets, there's nothing like having an index of sort of the goods you use. Pretty frightening. I put the video up on the blog. We have the head of Walmart literally saying in an interview that expects significant price increases. So it looks like the commodity increases are going to continue to roll in a big way. The other kind of propaganda we're seeing is, if you haven't seen, there's something called the Waymaker video. If you haven't seen it, please don't waste your time and look it up. But I've had more than a couple subscribers send it to me and say, oh my goodness, isn't this fabulous? And it's basically a young man inviting everybody to join in the revolution. I've said to everybody, send it to me. That probably came out of the CIA at Langley or some place like that. It's very orchestrated. And it's a reminder that I've promised to do an extended piece on sort of propaganda and manipulation. But we're seeing more and more of that. More and more of the opposition engineered by, in fact, the pro-centralization team to kind of, for a variety of purposes. Okay, so number one is the budget deficit and the possibility of a shutdown. Number two, and remember what I said, is the risk is these things in combination, of course, is Japan. What's the most important thing that happened in the first quarter? It was the tsunami and the devastation to Japan, and the devastation to a nuclear power plant that is still in a very, very troubled state. And of course, what this means to us, because we're watching a world where the likelihood of another earthquake or disaster, you know, we've had Haiti, we've had the disaster in the Gulf, these kinds of disasters are accelerating. George, you're at Urban Survival, put up a very interesting piece. I posted to it at the blog on the rise in the incidence of earthquakes. I said when we talked about Japan last time that this could have been a natural event or induced. I keep tracking sort of the information and economic patterns that emerge, trying to figure it out. And I think it's just, you know, too soon to get that information. I'm deeply suspicious that some of these natural disasters are, you know, are encouraged and not completely natural. Although, certainly the earthquake phenomena is a natural one, and there's plenty of propensity now along this ring of fire through the Pacific, up Asia, and back down through the America. So, but either one gives us, you know, if you look at whichever one it was, whether it was partly induced or whether it was a natural event, the every indication is that we're going to see more of these. And their impact on the economy has completely been sort of papered over by enormous monetary infusion of money into the economy. You know, we've kind of had a global QE3 thanks to the G7 central banks. So we've just seen massive more printing of money. It's part of the reason that precious metals has not corrected and has been moving up. There's just too much money pouring in. You know, QE2 is going on from the Federal Reserve, but now Japan has inspired some other. But that only papers it over. That we're talking about a very serious hit to the third largest economy in the world, and one that is devastating for the nuclear energy industry. And it could be devastating for food beyond Japan if Fukushima gets out of it's out of control now, but even worse. We had another earthquake today. There was a scare, one report that the entire Fukushima 50, now 300 plus engineers, had literally left the plant. So things could get much worse, particularly if the radiation spreads and gets into the food supply over North America and around the world. One of the things I continue to watch, and you see stories on the blog, is I'm watching the auto industry. One of the challenges we have globally is you'll see these very important industries where if you look at the capacity rising in Asia, whether it's Tata or Hyundai, you have tremendous overcapacity, and you have the Asian companies completely outcompeting General Motors. Ford seems to be holding its own, but General Motors is basically getting slaughtered and struggling with inventory and struggling with the United States government having to look good on their investment. And if you look at who's kind of come in, it's a much rougher crowd. And so one of the things I'm watching is the extent to which Nissan, Toyota, and Honda, who all gets really impacted hard by what is happening, what that's going to be in terms vis-a-vis General Motors. But watch that competition, because we may be watching a major industry competition where things are being decided by force and dirty tricks as opposed to market forces. In addition, what we've seen is a real beatdown on the nuclear industry worldwide, and without getting into the argument of whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, what it means is we're watching far more conservative practices go into effect, people canceling or mothballing nuclear facilities or plans for nuclear facilities or mothballing nuclear facilities, the older ones. And what that means is it's just upping the dependency on oil, which is great for the oil industry and the oil card, but it means more pressure on governments to make the economics go at a time when it's hard to do. Watch the impact on food. A very interesting story from the New York Times. Le Bernardin, one of the fanciest restaurants in New York, we used to always eat there when I was on Wall Street, is now testing for radiation on its seafood. Between what we've been dumping into the ocean in Japan and into the Gulf, it's kind of one of the most frightening things to contemplate is what may be happening to the ocean. We, as an aside, I keep trying to provide transcripts on the interviews that I think will be very helpful in you taking action. And we did do a transcript on the special we had with Dr. Laura Thompson on dealing with radiation poisoning. And I really encourage you to read it, not just for the possible risks of what radiation could do to our health, particularly if it gets into the food, but just any environmental pollution. There are so many of the things come up again and again, whether it's chemtrails or radiation poisoning, the things you need to do to stay detoxed and build your immune system. It's also a reminder, as we look at what's happening in Japan or the Gulf, to find local food sources. Because of the problems with the soil, because of the irrigation they're now doing when you go between states, there are so many reasons to want to know where your food's coming from. One of the things that is of most concern to me as I look at what happened in Japan, one of the subscribers wrote me right afterwards and said, you've got to read State of Fear, Michael Christian's book on a bunch of bad guys who get one of these, you know, new energy weapon systems and trigger a tsunami. And so I've been reading it. But one of the things that most concerns me is as follows. We have over 400 nuclear plants worldwide, and the engineers in charge of security, my guess, are not prepared for the kind of weaponry that they're up against, whether it's I put stories up on the blog about the Stuxnet virus compromising the Iran nuclear capability, you know, and I've put the videos of Dr. Judy Woods, who I'm going to try and get on the Soleri Report, talk about directed energy weapons. But it's a little bit frightening that that some of these nuclear plants may not know, not understand what kind of weaponry now exists that they're up against. And one of the reasons that I think about that a lot is when I designed in the early 90s $10 billion of loan sales, and it was interesting. I had a lot of knowledge of covert sabotage, particularly of financial process. I was able to design it so that I could protect against all sorts of Manchurian candidates and all sorts of crazy games, and I was really proud of the way I designed it because I thought I had figured out how to beat, you know, sort of the covert team, if you will, or the sort of shadow government. And what I didn't understand was I didn't understand the existence of Promise software. And if you don't understand Promise software and you want to, I would encourage you to get a fictional book about it. It's called Black Money by Michael Thomas, fascinating book that will help you understand one of the challenges on financial fraud and running government in this environment. But I did not understand that literally government agencies could team up with private players and use Promise software to access data through the banking settlement systems and in that way potentially have inside information to bid with. Now, my failure to understand the existence of Promise and the government's willing to sabotage their own sales made it impossible for me to know how to protect against sabotage by my own client. I know now, you know, and those were just loan sales. When it comes to nuclear plants, you know, we're talking about something. We're talking about one or two situations which could really collapse the global economy. So it's one of the reasons I think transparency about this kind of weaponry is really needed. And so I continue to struggle with how to find reliable information. Another important thing to understand about what happened in Japan is that I keep talking with subscribers who are concerned about collapse scenarios. And the vision they have of collapse is that the whole global economy collapses. And that is very, very unlikely. And that's one of the reasons why in describing the wrap-up this tonight, I said collapse comes to Fukushima, because collapse has been a sequential process that happens in one place and then another and then another, but it's not something that happens to everybody all at once. So during the 90s, we saw collapse in Russia. We saw it in Eastern Europe. We saw it in Latin America, very engineered. We saw it after the tsunami in Indonesia. We saw it in Haiti after the earthquake. Now we're watching it in the portion of Japan hit by the tsunami. So sometimes when I say my planning scenario is 5% chance of collapse, what we need to understand is the collapse scenario we need to prepare for and think about is not just where everything happens, again, very unlikely, but where our area or our industry or our household is collapsed when everything around us is not, or the majority of the world and the economy is not. And part of that is because the slow burn is basically about a process where the insiders take from the outsiders. So whether it's a natural event, which is then used to engage in disaster capitalism, you know, by a group of people who are opportunistically looking for subsidy, or whether it's engineered, it is a much more sequential rolling event, because what you're doing is you're systematically collapsing pieces to feed the whole. So the system doesn't collapse because it's composting pieces. Anyway, but it's one of the reasons, this kind of scenario is one of the reasons that we've talked a lot on the Soleri Report, and go back and listen if you haven't, about strategic stockpiling, about We did If Something Could Happen in the fourth quarter last year, this wonderful planning book from the American Institute for Economic Research. We had Larry Gonzalez on talking about deep survival, because the most important thing in a collapse scenario is not just what you stockpiled, but it's your mental acuity to deal with and your health to deal with. The most important thing, remember, it's much harder to confiscate your health if you have it than it is to confiscate your possessions. So your health is absolutely critical. And again, if you haven't looked, three of the transcripts we did in the first quarter that I thought would really help you is the a list of the best food documentaries in one movie, and then the transcript of Dr. Laura Thompson on radiation poisoning and the transcript of Dr. Gwen Scott on the 10 actions you can take to protect yourself against the health impacts of chemtrail. Okay, so I talked about the budget squabble. I talked about Japan. Now the increases in what I call oil card aggression. Literally 9 days after the tsunami in Japan, we see the UN resolution to go into Libya. Now, I know there's a connection. I'm not sure what all of it is, but when you shut down, when you lower nuclear production in the third largest economy, and you start shutting down plants in Germany at the same time that Europe is dependent on oil from Libya, well, it doesn't take a fool to understand that the net desire for oil and the net value of oil is going to go up. And so it's important to keep it pumping into Europe and not to China. 85% of Libya oil goes to Europe. They've been doing more and more deals with the Chinese. And so it makes what's happening in Libya for the Europeans that much more sensitive. And for the players who are trying to get the oil price up, again, the oil card, it's a dream opportunity to go in. Now, lest you think, it's interesting as you watch the emails and all the people objecting to an illegal war and criticizing Obama, the reality is the dollar is falling. There's a danger it could fall a lot in a way that would make the budget deficit problems infinitely worse. The dollar depends on being the premier oil transacting currency to be maintained. So part of what you're watching in Libya is not just about oil or water and some of the other valuable resources. What you're watching is an effort to stabilize and maintain the federal credit mechanism. Because it's just integrated down to the down to the core with the dollar and the value of the dollar. So those three things in competition create a lot of fluidness in the geopolitics, and they create a lot of fluidness in the cash flows. And there's a lot of squabbling in the background of corporate overheads that need cash. And that's always, when players need to fail or cut back, but they have enormous political power and weaponry, they don't just fail or cut back. They steal from others, whether it's war or bailouts. And that's the tension that we're watching. But the reality is they're starting to fight. Well, they've been fighting with each other, but the fighting with each other is going up now. There's one thing I'm not going to get into, but I keep an eye on, and that is we saw that one of the direct marketing firm that works for a lot of big financial institutions hacked into. A lot of people are getting emails from their broker or their credit card company or other financial institutions, big banks, saying that their email address has gone out with this hack. Normally, that wouldn't be something I'd pay a lot of attention to. However, If you watch a real hit on the economy, if you watch a real warfare attack, identity theft skyrocketing is a dead giveaway. And so I watch that as a potential symptom, and it's making me a little bit nervous. But keep an eye out, because if we start to see a real 2008 scenario, we could start to see professional systematic identity theft skyrocket. And so you want to be extra careful. We did a Solari report with Bob Sullivan on identity theft, some great suggestions on how to protect yourself. But if we do see a worsening in the economy, expect a rise there. I just want to mention, I'll talk a lot more about it next week with Franklin Sanders. Because of the increased risk in the environment starting with Japan, I am more concerned about downside risks, and so I've been recommending more silver to gold swaps, because gold is the more defensive play, the ultimate safe haven. A lot of people in the gold bug world who disagree with that, they think silver is going to the moon, and I'm not so much worried about going to the moon. I'm worried about not going into the basement. So I think again, gold is the premier safe haven. Okay, so those are the three big ones. Let me mention a couple of other things I think are really important that happened in the first quarter and what, you know, sort of I want on your radar screen. Food fascism, you know, the food fascists had a great quarter, that's all I can say. The pro-centralization team blossomed. Not only did they get the legislation, the food legislation, but they got a couple of unbelievable U.S. decisions, USDA decisions on genetically modified food. It's all been covered on the blog. They're getting a couple lawsuits, and I think what's good about it is the Food Freedom Group has finally realized what they're up against and how, you know, sort of dangerous this all is. I think they've been in a state of denial. We're seeing some early results from that, a couple of lawsuits which have been described up on the blog, and some resolution, small town after small town in Maine. I love those Yankees. There's nothing like, you know, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont to dig in and fight. They're passing a couple resolutions to basically say that the feds have no jurisdiction. And I think that's absolutely true. And so one of the things that's going to happen is we see this sort of the politics of reengineering rolling through state and local government, more and more people coming together and looking for the opportunities to assert local rights. We got a great question from a subscriber. How do we keep our local sheriff under the new Michigan Emergency Financial Managers Bill? This legislation gives the state the right to come in and replace our elected officials, including the local sheriff. It is inconceivable to me that under the Constitution that a state has a right to legislate away a sheriff. Now, I can say that. The reality is where there's no financial sovereignty, defending the law is difficult, if not impossible. But I'm going to put that question to Richard Mack and see what I can find out. Richard Mack is the sheriff we had on the Salary Report talking about who's your sheriff. And it's, if you haven't listened to it or read his books, it's really remarkable stuff. But I will, a great question. I'll put that question to him and report back when I have it. Okay. I just want to say, you know, I know I said it before, but I'm going to say it again. Anything you can do, and that's why we did the list of the top food documentaries, anything you can do to start a positive discussion with your family, friends, and communities that will help you build allies in creating a local food supply, I really, really encourage it. Now's the time to do it, and I'm hoping that that transcript will make it fun. And yes, gotten this question from another a couple more subscribers. Feel free to share those with family and friends where it's helpful to you in doing that. So, you know, feel free to share if it really serves your purpose of making some progress there. Okay, a note on political hysteria. Next sort of topic. Why are the Republicans acting so crazy is a wonderful essay by Sam Smith. I posted it up on the blog, and he's talking about the insanity of the political rhetoric right now. And I think it's important. One of the things he points out is ever since the Supreme Court has changed the rules allowing corporations essentially unlimited access to financing campaigns, that the rhetoric has gotten much worse, and I think that's true. The pressure, whether it's because of the falling dollar, whether it's because of the having to finally reconcile the budgets back to a real reality and deal with the constituencies, what we're seeing is, and it's the corporations pressing because they are hungry for subsidy. Remember, they're not, as a category, they are not economic beings, which means they need to keep getting more and more subsidy. They need assets at below market. They need government contracts. These are not entities that for the most part function in a market. They haven't evolved from market economies, and so they're not they're not fundamentally economic. They're very, very dependent on sort of government and a variety of these things being rigged for them. So, and not to say that there aren't parts of them that are very economic, not to say that people who don't work in big corporations don't work really hard, not to say that they haven't produced lots of very wonderful or efficient products. I'm not saying that in any, but if you look at the whole structure of the corporate model, it's highly dependent on government laws, regulations, and subsidy. Now, what's interesting is if you look at this rhetoric, there are kind of two fact patterns I want to point out to you. One is you'll see someone like Obama trying to explain why he's going into Libya. In fact, he has tremendous popular support. You know, again and again, we've shown that American citizens do not want the red button pushed. So one of the things he's trying to do is keep the red button from getting pushed. And we covered in Let's Go to the Movies, 3 Days of the Condor. There's a great quote from 3 Days of the Condor where a guy from the CIA says to the hero, he says, "It's simple economics. Today it's oil, right? In 10 or 15 years, food, plutonium, maybe even sooner. Now, what do you think the people are going to want from us then? Not now, then. Ask them when they're running out. Ask them when there's no heat in their homes and they're cold. Ask them when their engines stop. Ask them when people who have never known hunger start going hungry. You want to know something? They don't want us to ask them. They want us to go get it for them." I'm reading George Friedman's new book, The Next Decade, and I've asked him to see. I'm going to try and get him on in the second quarter. And one of the things he goes through is the struggle of having to manage an empire when people want you to go get the resources, but they don't want you to tell them, you know, they want a higher-minded vision of why you're doing it and the sort of funny position that puts leaders in. So part of the lies and the crazy rhetoric is the press of the slow burn. To keep the slow burn going, you run around and you do all these things. People want you to keep the slow burn going, but they don't want to have to face, you know, it's a very not nice truth what you're doing. Okay, fact pattern number two is there's a whole bunch of stuff you're trying to get done for which there's no popular support and has nothing to do with keep the slow burn going. You know, in many cases, it makes it worse because it destroys productivity. So we have an effort to shift assets out of governments and into corporations, whether it's a federal, state, or local government or governments around the world. We have all sorts of people trying to take advantage in the world of economic warfare and get a continued flow of subsidy by stealing from somebody else or using government to do a variety of things. But it's economy by war and economy by force. And you can't admit you're doing that, so it's always wonderful to go get some wacko or nut from a think tank is willing to be paid a lot of money to come up with some complete gobbledygook that justifies it. Now, why am I mentioning all of this? It's very, very important for you to not lose time. I want you to see the game and not lose time taking what they're saying seriously. I mean, I don't pay any attention to that stuff. You know, I read right through it because I'm trying to read what's really going on. But politicians have been trained to believe that we're going to believe what they say, not what they do. And you can't go there. You can't spend your time and energy refuting something that was gobbledygook spin movie from the get-go. We need to use our time to look into what's really going on and deal with that. So please don't lose time or sleep over the hysteria. I say that, and there are days when it's so bad, I just, you know, I either roll my eyes or want to punch somebody, and that's when I go take the dog for the walk. Financial coup d'etat, next topic. We're watching the world come to grips with what's now been changed from too big to fail to too big to fail and too big to jail. It's a tad depressing. But the Fed did lose the lawsuit at the Supreme Court. It kind of makes you wonder what's going on there. And they are now unloading the documentation on all the loans during the bailout, including loans to Libyan banks, very contradictory to stated policies. We're at war with Libya. Stay tuned over the next really 30 to 60 days as we see Bloomberg reporters and lots of other reporters digging in and really turning up one gem after another. It's going to be an enormous education process because that mechanism is not financing the United States. The federal government and the central bank are financing a global empire, And to finance that global empire during the financial coup d'etat, they stuffed a lot of fraudulent paper out, and then they bought it back or financed it. And if they hadn't, there would have been World War III, but a lot of dirty laundry is going to come out. It'll be very entertaining. Another trend I talked a lot about in the wrap-up, the weather gets weirder. It's going to keep getting weirder, and that's why if there's any collapse scenario, I want you to worry about is what's the weird weather in your area, and what is the disaster recovery plan appropriate to your situation and location, whether business or household? And we just had a wonderful subscriber take the emergency responder course out in LA and said it was absolutely fantastic. There are a lot of great emergency responder groups around the country, and they're giving courses. It may be, if it's something of interest to you, I think it's valuable. On our little investment club, our Solari Circle, we just had the person who had the most experience living through earthquakes give us a little primer on how to live through the earthquake. I put the links up from FEMA on the blog on sort of how to live through this or that or this or that. Next topic, Obama myth evolves. Obama announces his presidency. He's doing poorly in the polls, high disapproval ratings at the same time. I can't fathom where the Republicans could beat him. He's been much too wonderful for the banks and Wall Street. Given all the hysterical political rhetoric, one of his real strengths is he stays on the positive. He stays away from the rhetoric. So I think it's going to be anything can happen. It's a long time before an election, and anything can happen. But it's hard for me to envision how someone else gets the White House in 2012. But it'll continue to be a bitter fight. Looking for a place to hide bond stocks and precious metals. This all makes for a very nerve-wracking situation for the markets. I think at the beginning of the year, I said the chances of, I gave you my scenarios for the year, slow burn 70%, 2008 redux, repeat of that kind of crash, 20 to 25%, 5% of collapse. Now I'm changing that today to 65% slow burn, 25 to 30% chance of a 2008, because I think the combination of the budget squabble, if we go into a shutdown and it becomes protracted, combined with Japan, combined with the possibility of more earthquakes, combined with whatever might happen at Fukushima if that turns negative, plus the hunt for resources in northern Africa and the Middle East, you're talking about a combined situation where we have very powerful people who are looking to take advantage of that, and that's a big wild card, and so it's for that reason that I'm upping it. I still believe that our number one risk that we have to protect it against is the slow burn, and I come back to the importance of doing everything you can to get the tapeworm out of your life. In other words, do whether it's your transactions, whether it's your work, everything you can do to put distance between them and you and focus your efforts on building the positive for yourself and kind of ignoring them, it's a plan. We had Jeanine Roth on with her new book, Lost and Found, about losing everything through Madoff. And it's a wonderful story of someone who said, I'm not going to spend my life being made crazy by this. I'm not going to get embroiled in hating Madoff and going to the court and blah, 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 blah. I'm going to focus on completely, rebuilding and turning this lemon into lemonade. It's really a remarkable story of dealing with adversity. And I talked to Jeanine tonight. She's on book tour. She was out in Phoenix. And I said, the whole country is going to have to go through, with some exception, a lot of people in this country are going to have to go through the same kind of process you've gone through. And, so it's very inspirational. If you haven't listened to it, I recommend it. Our hero for the first quarter, I think you already know who this is going to be. It's the Fukushima 50. I spoke a lot about them in March. I put up a poem from Steven Spender that I love that just says everything I have to say about them. It says, I'll just read you the last stanza. It says, near the snow, near the sun, in the highest fields. See how these names are fetid by the waving grass and by the streamers of white cloud and whispers of wind in the listening sky, the name of those who in their lives fought for life, who wore at their hearts the fire center. Born of the sun, they traveled a short while towards the sun and left the vivid air signed with their honor. The Fukushima 50 for me are just a reminder of how many great humans there are, and we don't enjoy that because we're you know, there's nothing more important for the optimization of an economy or of wealth than great leadership. And there's nothing harder than trying to preserve or optimize wealth when you're struggling without great leadership. And part of the reason we're struggling without great leadership is we have lots of leaders who I think could be great, but they are struggling with invisible forces and weaponry that the general populations that they're leading don't understand. And so part of resolving that and getting people into a position where they can be great leaders again, there's just nothing more important. Looking ahead, some great highlights, some things I'm going to focus a lot in the second quarter on national security. Our next, our first speaker in May is going to be Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the chief of staff to Colin Powell, very successful military career, and then followed Colin Powell to the State Department when he became Secretary of State. He's been very publicly critical of the Bush administration and what happened in the events leading up to the Iraq War. He's teaching national security at Williams and Mary College in Virginia, and I want him to sort of put on the Oval Office hat and say, okay, you're sitting in the Oval Office. The world is as it is. What are the national security issues that we need to be thinking about? Why is the president doing what he's doing? Why is the Congress doing what he's doing? I've invited George Friedman. I'm going to work hard to try and get him his book, The Next Decade. I think is very, very useful. And so we're going to do a lot on national security because we're in a political managed economy. It's going to get more political. And so if you want to understand the background of what's going on, whether it's stock market, bond market, precious metals, you know, we're moving into a world where you're going to start trading places and you're going to start trading them around political risk. And so I want to start having that conversation with you in more depth. Okay, let's go to the movies. I want to talk about two children's movies, and I would just caution you, these really are children's movies, so the key concepts are unbelievably valuable. But if you watch them, if you haven't watched Neverending Story and Neverending Story Part 2, I want to encourage you to do that with the children you love, you know, because these are not entirely adult movies. But Neverending Story is based on the German fantasy epic by the same name, Neverending Story, and it was recommended to me by somebody whose strategic advice I value immensely, and only this person could have got me to watch them without any kids. I usually try and watch them with my cousins, but I didn't have my cousins for this one. But I'm very glad I did. It's the story of a young man who's lost his mother. He's bullied in school. He's alienated from his dad. And so he decides, he goes into a bookstore and finds a book called The Never Ending Story. And as a result, he falls through the book, or through the book, he enters a world, literally leaves the material world and enters this world. The world is called Fantasia. And it turns out that Fantasia, which is a remarkably imaginative and interesting place, Fantasia represents the collective hopes and dreams of the human race. Think of it as our collective imagination. And Fantasia is in real trouble. The young man's name is Bastian. And Fantasia is in trouble, and they're seeking help from Bastian because they're in the process of being slowly destroyed by a force called the Nothing. And the Nothing is the force that is created when humans give up their dreams and their hopes and their imagination. When the humans lose their creative force, then Fantasia starts to disappear as a world. And in the first story, Neverending Story, the first one, what you go around Fantasia with Bastian as he tries to figure out what's going on, and figure out how he can stop the nothing from destroying Fantasia. And it's a very interesting metaphor with what's happening in the slow burn, because there is nothing more oppressive to our dreams and imaginations than tyranny. And what we're dealing with in you know, every year more rules and regulations, every year more expenses, every year falling income, every year more lies. What we're dealing with is something which is very, very grinding and, you know, inserts a whole lot of weirdness and perversion into our minds or our day-to-day reality. And so we tend to give up on our dreams and our imagination, and that's the opposite of what we need to do. The last thing we can afford to do is give up on our imagination, because it's our imagination that allows us to continually jump the curve inside the slow burn. If you're going to outwit the slow burn, you're going to do it. You need to come from that place of laughter, from that higher mind that gives you, you know, that imagination brings. And so it's a very interesting commentary on the importance of dreams and imagination and this kind of force, the nothing, because I really... The more I see the never-ending story, the more I feel like, oh, the nothing is exactly what I'm dealing with day to day to day. Now, in part two, our young hero is tricked by the evil sorceress in Fantasia. What she wants to do is defeat him, and the way she's defeating him is she gets him to, he has the power within Fantasia to satisfy his desires. But every time he gets his wish, he loses a memory. And as he loses his memories, his mind weakens and he becomes less and less powerful. He goes through a dumbing down. And again, it's a wonderful metaphor for the extent to which all these consumer delights that we've been given, and what you'll sometimes hear Franklin Sanders call them the treats of the tapeworm, the extent to which they detach us from our memories and our connection to other people. It's very, very interesting. I know one of the things I said in Dr. Scott's interview, and I sent it out again in the update we sent out with the podcast. Let me just read it to you. My focus is money, so why do I keep talking about health? Because the way to steal somebody's money is first to steal their mind. You give them false maps of reality. You fill their head with subliminal programming. You encourage them with false fears. You make them tired and sick. All of these are tricks in the game of economic warfare. Well, you see it beautifully in Never Ending Story 2, because our hero is slowly losing his mind because he keeps getting the desire, these desires satisfied. And so it's a very interesting thing to think about. How to immunize yourself from you being tricked with your desires into kind of giving up your understanding of what has value. Anyway, we come to one of the last scenes in the movie in part two, and our hero is down to one wish. He's got one memory left, and if he uses that wish other than to go home and see his father, he will forget his father and be trapped in Fantasia. So the sorceress offers him his chance to make his last wish and tries to trick him into wishing to go back to his father and home. And so instead he says, "I wish you had a heart." And the evil sorceress feels emotion and as a result dissolves in a sort of an explosion of light, because she can't handle having a heart and still doing evil. And it's an absolutely beautiful metaphor, again, because if I had one wish, if the genie jumped out of the bottle and I had one wish, it would be that everybody participating in the breakaway civilization woke up tomorrow morning and suddenly had a heart. Because if they did, and I won't bore you with all the things that are done when you live and come up in that world there's ceremonies called Turn Your Heart to Stone. But when somebody's heart is rejuvenated, suddenly that changes everything. If we can bring them into a higher mind, a lot can change. And if you look at the weaponry and technology they have, it's almost easier to, to wish they had a heart than have a squabble with their directed energy weapons. The last reason I wanted to really mention these wonderful movies to you is because this force, the nothing, is working on us every day and every week. We're dealing with it now. A lot of it works through the money systems and the way money can divide people against each other and financial incentives can. And so it's worth thinking about this and seeing the nothing for what it is and the strategies to deal with the nothing, because it's something we're all going to have to do. And getting clever at avoiding the nothing and dealing with the nothing is one of the most important strategies to success in the slow burn, and it's part and parcel of where I started, which is appreciate the miracle, because there is a miracle going on, and you need to access that miracle, and you need to use that miracle to protect you from the nothing, because we do need protection from the nothing, and it is there. It can be accessed. Okay, before we close, let's go to the movie. I just wanted to mention there's a documentary coming. I just put the announcement up on my website. It's called Thrive! Exclamation mark. It's going to be launched, the premiere's November 11th, 2011. That's 11-11-11. You can sign up for updates. The link is up on the blog. It's one that I was one of many people participating in. It's one I'm very excited is coming, and I think it will be a wonderful documentary to inspire and give you lots of ideas about how to understand and out with the nothing. More on Thrive later. Okay, closing. Next week, Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders. We're going to talk about what are the signs that signal a correction, and I want to talk about the risk issues I've talked about tonight and how they could dovetail with what might happen in the precious metals market, whether it's a correction or we just keep on rising. But clearly, a lot has been happening in the environment to make precious metals and even more attractive than it was even last month. April 21st, at subscriber request, we're having Blake Levitt back. Beware the smart grid. A lot of the subscribers in California and a number of other states are dealing with this. It's very important. And so we're going to have Blake back just to get into smart grids, what they are, why you need to be concerned, and how to avoid them. May 7th, again, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson on the national security. So, ladies and gentlemen, until next week, please don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.